This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide. They're inconvenient, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today I'm going to catch up with the writer Zadie Smith to talk about her new novel, and the state of the novel in general. And we'll have a brief word about Thanksgiving dinner, or rather a word from Thanksgiving dinner. We're going to start, though, in Washington, where the known world is in absolute turmoil. Democrats are trying to figure out a strategy to create themselves as a resistance movement, and the Republican establishment is scrambling to regain whatever influence it has left. Being a Washington insider in the age of Trump just got a lot more complicated, and complicated for people like David Frum. Frum has gold standard credentials as a neocon. He was a speechwriter for George W. Bush, credited with inventing the term the axis of evil. And he's done work for the Manhattan Institute and the Weekly Standard. But those are exactly the kind of conservative institutions that Trump's campaign and now his transition team is treating with a degree of contempt. And David Frum, in the end, voted for Hillary Clinton. David, you've been very skeptical about the direction of the Republican Party for a long time now. I've been reading you in The Atlantic and articles elsewhere, where you've been very worried about the course that conservatism has taken, particularly within the GOP. And Trump has had you worried for a long time, hasn't he?
Yes, but at the beginning, I have to say, I was susceptible to some of his appeal. When Trump appeared on the scene as a serious candidate in the summer of 2015, I was impressed because he did touch on some issues that I thought were important, the need to reorient toward a more middle-class kind of economics, to not to promise what could never be delivered, radical changes in programs like Medicare and Social Security. And I also agreed with him that the United States needed a more cautious approach to immigration. So I suppose I fell into the category of those whom my friend Ross Douthat has called Trump curious. The problem with Trump is that Trump's own character and personality and deficiencies overwhelmed some of the more interesting and promising things that he talked about, at least at the beginning of his campaign.
Well, you've been worried about the state of the party for a long time and its ability to win and retain power. And now here it is.
Well, elections aren't won on policy. Elections are won on identification. And he was able to persuade sufficient numbers of people in the right states to believe in just enough way to give him the presidency without actually winning the popular vote, that he could make a massive improvement in the job prospects of his voters, blue-collar voters, especially men. But by the way, you can see it shaping up that what he's going to do, we are going to have, it looks like, a massive fiscal stimulus in the United States. We're going to have a big tax cut, a big defense buildup, and a big roads and highways bill. You put all of those things together, and you are going to see a big increase in demand-led growth. tax a lot, spend a lot, borrow a lot. It always works. It doesn't always work forever. It doesn't always work for a very long time. It often results in inflation. It may distort the structure of the economy, but within the four-year cycle, it works.
Now, let's be clear. You voted for Hillary Clinton, which I assume it, to a great extent, David, was a painful act for you.
I voted in an absentee ballot, and the ballot remained in my outbox for 3 days. It was painful.
Describe your thinking. What did you have to decide over? What made you decide what you did?
I became convinced that what was on the ballot this time were not policies, but the very structure of American legality, the rule of law, the constitutional system. And the anxiety I had and have about Donald Trump is, will he follow the basic rules of how American democracy is supposed to work? Here's just one telling indication of what we have to worry about. On the night that Donald Trump put away the Electoral College, there was a giant collapse in financial markets. But those markets recovered over the next 18 hours, and things sort of got back to normal. But among the biggest spikes was the stock of Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank is the only bank that will lend to Donald Trump. The Department of Justice had imposed or was demanding from Deutsche Bank a fine for misconduct during the financial crisis of $14 billion. The markets clearly decided that if Donald Trump is the president, that fine is going to go away. Now, presidents aren't supposed to meddle with fines, especially of their lenders, but the markets clearly said Donald Trump is not going to abide by that rule, and Deutsche Bank stock, which had been in terrible trouble before, spiked dramatically.
I was on a television show, and the host of the show, Fareed Zakaria, said, you know, it's impossible for me to get anybody from the, you know, traditional conservative intelligentsia to come on the show and speak up in favor of Donald Trump. You could get the usual surrogates and talking heads that you always see on CNN or MSNBC, the same half a dozen people who've never written anything or not deep policy thinkers. They're there as surrogates. What does this mean for conservative thinking in this country?
Well, Fareed Zakaria's show airs on Sunday, but it records on Thursdays. Had he waited one more day, I think his problem would have gone away. People jump on bandwagons. That is the nature of politics. It's the nature of Washington. And every hour, you see people who had been previously opposed to Donald Trump, who are prominent intellectual names, making some kind or other peace with him. The demonstrations that have happened over the past few nights have stimulated it. That a lot of people who had disliked Donald Trump could look at those demonstrations and say, right, these are people I dislike even more. You know, the safety pin movement is everything that irritates me about liberal weepiness. And I'm reconciled to Donald Trump, or at least I'm hopeful about him. And that is happening at a very fast pace.
To the alt-right, whether it makes its appearance on Twitter or Facebook, aren't you just like me, but with a redder complexion? In other words, the cartoon of you has got to be someone who's disconnected and elite and out of it. How are you received? I know how I am as a liberal. I wonder how you are as a conservative.
Oh, well, you know, there's a lot of abusive stuff on social media. I seem to get off rather lightly. The question of being, however, you know, an elitist cut off. I mean, yeah, that's all true. I mean, I have a fancy education. I live in Washington, D.C. I spend most of my time in the nicer parts of North America. You know, I'm reasonably financially secure. Don't work with my hands. That's all true. And I don't take that as a self-indictment, because one of the things that I strongly believe about politics is that, look, you're always going to have, in any human society, people who are more privileged than others. That's just the way it works. And the job of those people then is to realize their privileges and then to be extra responsible. One of the things I don't like a lot about the campus left, with all of these, you know, attacks on people's privileges, that their goal is to drive people to pretend that they don't have advantages that they have. My concern is not that we have these out-of-touch elites. My concern is that we have these irresponsible and ungenerous elites that will not accept the duties that go with their position.
You've written that Trump's first order of business will be to protect and further his own brand, his finances. This seems almost optimistic to me, the idea that he'll be so absorbed with his own affairs to straightaway follow through on all the hateful campaign promises he's made. Is this really the best scenario?
Oh, Well, maybe I'm influenced here. I've spent a lot of time this year, as you have done over your distinguished career, in East Central Europe. And it's full of rising demagogues. And when an American journalist go to Hungary or Poland, what they are struck by are, you know, the bigotries, the anti-Semitism. They are a very strong force that attacks on gypsies, on migrants of various kinds. And they also notice in the background a certain amount of stealing. But the stealing is the point. That's what all these other things are there to enable. I mean, somebody like Viktor Orban, who was
in Hungary.
In Hungary, the Prime Minister of Hungary, a highly authoritarian leader, who started off at the beginning of his career as a, you know, European liberal, admirer of Margaret Thatcher, somebody wanted to make Hungary a modern country, integrated into the EU and NATO, discovered enormous economic possibilities and realized the only way to get them was to inflame people's fears. But it was always about making himself rich. You can do, and in the course of self-enrichment, you can do a lot of damage to a country's institutions and rule of law of a kind that endures for decades. And if the Trump administration were to play out the way I fear it will, you know, you're not going to see Jim Crow reimposed, but what you may see at the end of it is the Department of Justice no longer works the way a first world Department of Justice is supposed to work.
And what will it be used for?
It will be used for protecting the president's interests and those of his friends from investigation.
I just want to emphasize this. This is a conservative Republican intellectual warning us that the Justice Department might be used as an arm of the presidency to protect his economic interests. Am I getting that right?
To protect him from investigation.
That's an incredible, incredible thing. And how else would you fill out the notion of what the worst case scenario of a Trump presidency is?
I think that that's bad enough. I mean, the very worst thing that Trump will do or could do in his first year of his presidency, he's already done. And that is during the campaign to raise a question about whether the U.S. commitment to defend NATO partners will be honored. That's one of those things that once said can't be unsaid. The question mark now is always there, and everybody, friend and foe, has to take into account that possibility.
So if your concern is that if Vladimir Putin wants to make a move on Estonia, which is a NATO member state, the game's already up.
Yeah, he's been given information. By the way, that's how you get into wars, by the way. What's very important in these security situations, and this is, I mean, the lesson that President Obama taught us with his havering about the red lines in Syria. For a great power like the United States, it matters less where you draw the line than that everyone knows that the line is enforced. One of the craziest things that people said during the last phase of the campaign was that if Hillary Clinton is elected, we'll have a war with Russia because she'll be clear about what the lines are. Russia is much weaker than the United States. Clear lines, they will respect. Blurry lines tempt them. Because when you think about what Russia might do in Estonia, for example, don't think about, you know, tanks rolling across the border. Think about small groups of irregular forces the Russians can disavow, who then carry out sabotage. Think about cyber warfare. Think about the planting of false news stories. Thinking about manipulating the political processes of these countries. We've seen pro-Putin leaders elected just in this past week in Moldova and Bulgaria. Moldova is on the other side of Ukraine and makes it that much more difficult for a democratic Ukraine to get off the ground. These are major, major concerns. And above all, and this is the thing, I think we say, what is it that puts me to 11? On Trump alarmism. It is the very clear probability that Russian intelligence directly manipulated an American election. And this is not just a partisan issue because the fact that this could happen on President Obama's watch is such a statement of contempt and disdain for what I regard as his weak leadership. I mean, how could the Russians dare? How could they think they could do such a thing? But they did it. The intelligence operation succeeded. They had an impact on the election in such a close electoral college contest, probably enough to put their preferred candidate over the top. And the rest of us have to live with the consequences. I don't know that Donald Trump will continue to feel any gratitude for Vladimir Putin. I rather doubt that. But the Russians have scored a win at the expense of our institutions.
David, you are Canadian and you live in Washington, D.C. Are you sticking around or are you going back home?
You mean to escape the Trumpite terror?
Something like that.
I do a national now. I have a family here, and of course, I. You know, people sometimes say things when you get some negative comments on social media, but, you know, you're being very courageous to stand up for this. I think, you know, if we were living in Vladimir Putin's Russia and you were presented with the offer, look, you continue to resist the authorities and you get killed. If you cooperate with them, we'll make you rich. You have to pause and think about that. But if in this society, the downside is you get negative comments on social media and the upside is you get invited to the White House Hanukkah party, I don't think you have any excuse for
but do you
not,
but do
not
you think that's
right
a limit of the threat? A lot of people are very concerned about the First Amendment under somebody who has all the opinions he does about the press and also has talked about changing libel laws, about all kinds of things about attacking the press.
Look, it can't happen unless you let it. So I don't agree that everything's going to be fine. And I think it's actually a very dangerous thing to say. And an aroused citizenry working to defend – I've used the word, I realize, institutions a lot in this interview. And that, I think, is what the theme of the Trump presidency is about. One of the things I try to say to my liberal friends, if you find yourself tempted to criticize Donald Trump for doing something that if Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio were the president, he would also do, bite your tongue. That's not what this is about. Conservatives get to win elections sometimes, and when they do, they will do conservative things, just as liberals do. We have a common stake in rules of the game, and those are the things that are in danger in this Trump presidency, and those are the things you have to rally to defend. We absolutely have the capacity to protect them, and so shame on us if we don't.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Frum is a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. There's more to come on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious, but with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Thanksgiving is around the corner, and the cranberry sauce would like your attention, if just for a moment.
Hello. Hi. I have something to say here. I'm just going to take a minute here. Now, I get it. I'm the cute one. I'm sweet. I'm red. I plop out of a can. It's fun. But enough is enough. My therapist told me to be direct about my feelings, so before you all dig in and give your thanks, I would like to say a few things that have been on my mind. Because damn it, I'm a legitimate part of the meal, and it's about time I was treated as such. I guess it's my fault for assuming I was anything more than a glorified dipping sauce to you people. Do you think I don't see what you see? I stick out like a sore thumb. A red, wobbly sore thumb with the ridges from my can still branded into my side, shaming me. You're store-bought freak. I'm not the disgusting one here. You're disgusting. The way you people talk, belch, Indulge in your orgies of savory fats. What a feast! What a spread! Oh, the turkey looks divine! Did you make the stuffing yourself? And oh, what is that? Cranberry sauce? Yeah, it is. It is cranberry sauce. But I can join in the fun. I can give thanks. I'm thankful to Frank for running back into the kitchen to get that novelty turkey spoon to serve me with, like I wasn't already everybody's monkey in a sailor suit. I'm thankful to wide-eyed college gal Kate for saying that the only good thing about me is that I'm vegan. Keep making a difference, Kate. The world needs you. I'm thankful to dumb baby Julie for mashing me onto her face as part of her desperate, pandering clown routine. But most of all, I'm thankful to each of the cousins from Weehawken, because without those mouth breathers, I wouldn't be gobbled up like slop in a trough, like some sort of sweet Spam! Just because I'm ocean spray doesn't mean I can't cry. I've got feelings, I'm scrumptious, and I deserve more. So thanks, thank you very much, and by all means, bon appetit.
The cranberry sauce has something to say. That's a piece by Will Steven, a writer on Saturday Night Live, and it was performed for the New Yorker Radio Hour by Shiraka Dunlap. You know, there's a story about the British novelist Anthony Trollope. Trollope apparently wrote so quickly and so efficiently that when he'd finish a novel at, say, 9 in the morning, he'd write the end, and then he'd write the first sentence 15 minutes later of the very next book. But most writers these days give themselves at least a little break between books. And that's exactly when I caught up with Zadie Smith.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sorry. I'm going to take my jacket off. We'll see what occurs. It's a good so time for fiction, though, don't you think? I feel like, I don't know, I'm doing a lot of reading, and it seems like a good time.
Are you? What are you reading?
Lots of girls, Alexandra Kleeman, Natessa Moshfegh. I don't know, it seems like an exciting time.
So you really keep up?
Well, not normally, because I'm working, but when I finish working, I
you go on a binge?
Yeah.
Joy Williams. One reason it's always great to talk to Zadie Smith is, and forgive the bad cliche, she's just someone who's got her finger on the pulse. She's been writing entertaining but very serious books dealing with race and ethnicity and gender for a long time now, a decade and a half. Her first bestseller, it's amazing to remember, was White Teeth when she was 24. She's written essays about how we feel about global warming. And recently she wrote about Brexit, a very sad and moving piece about how Britain has profoundly changed. And she's published personal essays and some terrific short stories, of course, in The New Yorker. Her new novel, Swing Time, is her first in 4 years.
The book is about two girls who meet when they're about 7 years old in a dance class. But I thought about it as a kind of fable about blackness. That's really how I thought about it. And actually, when I just finished this book, Homegoing, by Yar Gyasi, who is, I think, almost half my age. And I saw, even though the novels don't have anything plot-wise in common, it seemed to me the same instinct. Like, she sat down to write a novel about the entirety of the diaspora in this incredible intensification, 300 pages she does it in. Mine is longer and looser. But I was trying to imagine the idea of one life somehow thematically speaking for a lot of different lives.
Why did you settle on dancing as a motor for this?
For the same kind of essentialist reasons. I was thinking of something I connect deeply with the communal experience of blackness, and dance is one of those things, I realized. Mm. Whenever I'm thinking about race, I always think of it exactly on that line of generalization. So we are thought of as a certain kind of people with certain kind of qualities, whether you're Jewish or black or Irish, or and those things are both what is held against you and also what you hold close. It's on such a strange border. You hate to be stereotyped, right, or generalized, and yet the borders by which you mark your community are exactly about the things that you have in common or you considered shared across this great diaspora. That line is where I'm always writing to, that strange double edge.
I want you to, if you would, I'd love to have you read from the novel where your narrator, the unnamed narrator, is meeting her close friend Tracy.
Sure. My mind was on Tracy and on the soles of her ballet shoes, upon which I now read Freed, clearly stamped in the leather. Her natural arches were two hummingbirds in flight, curved in on themselves. My own feet were square and flat. They seemed to grind through the positions. I felt like a toddler, placing wooden blocks at a series of right angles to each other. "Flutter, flutter, flutter," said Isabel. "Yes, that's lovely, Tracy." Compliments made Tracy throw her head back and flare her little pig nose awfully. Aside from that, she was perfection. I was besotted. Her mother seemed equally infatuated. Her commitment to those classes seemed the only consistent feature of what we would now call her parenting. She came to class more than any other mother, and while there, her attention rarely wavered from her daughter's feet. My own mother's focus was always elsewhere. She could never simply sit somewhere and let time pass. She always had to be learning something. She might arrive at the beginning of class with, say, the black Jacobins in hand, and by the time I came over to ask her to swap my ballet shoes for tap, she'd already be 100 pages through. Later, when my father took over, he either slept or went for a walk, the parental euphemism for smoking in the churchyard. At this early stage, Tracy and I were not friends or enemies or even acquaintances. We barely spoke. Yet there was always this mutual awareness, an invisible band strung between us, connecting us, and preventing us from straying too deeply into relations with others. Technically, I spoke more to Lily Bingham, who went to my school, and Tracy's own standby was sad old Danica Babich. With her ripped tights and thick accent, she lived on Tracy's corridor. But though we giggled and joked with these white girls during class, and although they had every right to assume that they were our focus, our central concern, that we were to them the good friends we appeared to be, as soon as it came to break time and squash and biscuits, Tracy and I lined up next to each other every time. It was almost unconscious, two iron filings drawn to a magnet.
Female friendship is at the absolute center of this book. Can you talk a little bit about that? That seems to be a subject that's not only yours for the moment, but it's certainly Ferrante's and others. Why now?
I was thinking about that too. In two areas, like, it's structural. It's to do with the fact, to me, that women are, with families, are writing more than they have in human history. And one of the things which is very important in female life is this relationship. I don't know a woman who hasn't had these intense childhood friendships with which she still has a kind of ambivalent or stressful reaction to. But we never heard of them because men were writing these books for the most part. And women, when they began to write en masse, had this feeling of inhibition, like, well, which stories will matter? I certainly, when I wrote White Teeth, wrote somewhat in drag, I think, right? You write with the idea of, well, what is a story? And a story is certainly about, there are men at the center of that story, and a masculine conception, I think. To feel free, you need to have examples of it before you and space. And I think what's happening now is a lot of women writers feeling something of that freedom, that their subjects are not small or domestic or uninteresting, that they are to the material of the novel.
Sadie, I think this is a departure for you in a technical term. You're writing this book in first person.
Right.
Why did you resist that before?
A bit of British snobbery, probably, and
or British reluctance.
Reluctance and misunderstanding of what the form is. Like, once I started writing in it, I saw all these possibilities.
Well, explain to an American listener why there is a snobbery at all in not writing in first person.
I think I've been writing about this recently, thinking about it. I think it's about Shakespeare, actually, the root of it, because we're told from a very young age that Shakespeare is the greatest writer in the world. Not coincidentally from England, and that his greatness is exactly this negative capability, right? This incredible broad act of empathy. In his ideal mode, he is both a black man and a Jew and a woman and an old man and a child and etc. And this is idealized in British life, I think, as the aim of literature, which is a kind of ethical and aesthetic confusion in my view, but one that I was very much under as a student. And the first person, I think, is considered an indulgence or something bordering on the memoiristic, or, you know, or certainly I did think of it that way, I think.
Huh.
And also basically limited. Like, if you're just talking about how you feel, what about everybody else in the picture? But that's a very infantile idea of the first person.
So when you set out in first person, did you find it liberating or the opposite?
I thought it was a tool that could be used. Like, it's a literary effect among many others. Like, when I read, when you read Nausgaard or Ferrante or people genuinely writing a straight memoir, there is the idea on the reader's part that this is in some way more authentic, right? That's the idea. But the writer knows that, I mean, I know that Nausgaard does not remember what he said to his father in 1974. I know that.
Or what he had for breakfast.
No, nobody remembers these things. So it's a literary effect and an extremely powerful one. Because one of them, the effects of it is the reader constantly asking themselves, well, is this you? And the frisson of that is very useful. It can be manipulated, just like one key amongst many that you play.
In fact, it to such a degree that you get to the end of the novel and there's a scene in which Daryl Pinkney arrives.
Yes, I put Daryl in.
A real-life person who we both know.
Yeah.
And James Fenton.
Yeah, that was the only real folk. It was the thrill of doing it, of entering them into the fiction. Also the voraciousness of fiction, right, that it can eat up reality.
And do whatever it wants.
And do whatever it wants. It is like a fundamentally immoral form, right? You have to deal with its impurity. It's why it makes people uncomfortable a lot of the time.
Said, you wrote a remarkable article for the New York Review of Books some years ago called Speaking in Tongues, and it was about being multi-voiced. And it was, at first, it was about Obama's ability to be multi-voiced, the way he would speak in a black church on the south side of Chicago, and then he would speak in deeper southern Illinois to what we now call the white working class. That's also part of you. It's also part of you as a person and as a writer, and maybe it's part of all of us in some way or another. Now that Obama is leaving office, how do you look back on that article and how your evaluation of him and how well or not he used that ability to be multi-voiced to confront that huge issue of race?
I think his instinct to please many people at the same time or to speak to many people at the same time had a certain difficulty, right? Because at a certain point, people want from you a commitment to stand in one place with them. And I think he's constitutionally incapable of doing that. There have been moments in the church when he spoke and sang.
In Charleston.
Yeah. It doesn't surprise me because I always thought of him as a writer first, of having a writer mentality. But
he disappointed you as a leader?
No, he never. I think there is no person who will ever take up that office, probably in my lifetime, who I admire more. That's never going to happen. But the person I admire, that's not always an effective political figure. But I mean that as a compliment to him as a human.
But where did he let you down? Where did his politics let you down and were not, say, firm enough or clear enough?
I think in times of emergency, and I think for black people in America in the past few years, this has felt like an emergency. The kind of flexibility he prizes doesn't feel like much. We at times needed someone to stand directly with us and lay a line down. And I think that was the problem.
When you talk about it being an emergency, do you get a sense that in the empirical sense that things are worse now?
I think it's about historical time, this incredible impatience. As far as I can see, I'm an outsider, but the African Americans have been asked time and time again to be patient.
Letter from Birmingham Jail is all about that.
Right. It's always
the insistence on not being patient,
right.
Enough with patience.
To me, it's about generations of wasted talent. That is always my feeling politically, is that you're asking people to waste what is greatest amongst their people, to never even find out what they are capable of. And it feels late in the day to still be making that argument and still seeing generations of young black people not fulfilling their capacity.
Zadie, when you finish a book, as you have now, you give yourself a break? Do you breathe?
I'm trying to give myself a break. And this time I'm just trying to be in the world. you know, go and pick up my kids, sit in Washington Square, go and see some culture, do something. Writing is a real way of controlling pleasure, someone suggested to me recently, and I think it's very true. It's a strange person who takes it up.
Sadie, you've talked about the business of writing as, in the end of ends, an act for you of ultimately of disappointment. And I just wonder if you ever finish a book and you have some feeling of deeper satisfaction, that you can at some level admit to yourself that you've written the book that you wanted to write.
No, this time I do have it, much more than before.
For the first time?
Definitely for the first time.
Is it the book or you grew up in some way?
Maybe both. I heard Saffron Foer speaking yesterday at my place of work, and he said something smart about wanting to be known, that both readers and writers want this. And it's a great temptation every day to present yourself in a way that doesn't allow for that. But I did feel, particularly in the shape of these sentences, that I got closer to something that I wanted, and that was more honest. So I'm happy. But I'm always happiest, to be honest, reading. That is the pleasure source for me.
Writing is the thing you bring a lunch bucket to, and it's the job that allows you to be liberated to read and be with your family and friends? You're going to do one of these things again. I'm patting the novel
I think I'll always write. The novel doesn't have to, even as a form, it doesn't have to continue forever, you know. It's like late in the day of the novel. Like, I was with a lot of teenagers last summer, and one of them was writing a novel which had quite a large audience on a phone app, and she already had like not just hundreds but thousands of people reading this thing. I don't think our model, the thing we both grew up with,
pages, ink, 400 pages.
But it's not, to me, it's not a sad matter. Like, we're not going to live that much, you know. We're going to die in 30 to 40 years.
I'm going to live forever. Pomegranate
right.
juice,
okay,
the
so
gym, etc.
But New Yorkers will live forever. Yes. But for the rest of us, we're going to die.
Sorry,
in
sorry, that'll
not
happen.
Too long time. If they just we mosey along together till the end of this, that's fine with me. But the kids will be on a different track altogether.
Ah, the kids. Thanks.
Thank you.
Zadie Smith's new book is called Swing Time, and you can find everything she's written for The New Yorker, including a fantastic profile of the comedy team Key and Peele, at newyorkerradio.org.
My colleague David Haglund, who's the literary editor of newyorker.com, has dropped by the office, and he's going to tell me what he's into these days, because that's the only way I ever know anything.
Well, and, you know, these days lately, I've been looking for the things that reliably cheer me up, pick me up, divert me from some of the more awful things in the world. So I have found myself going...
That's not pharmacological.
That's right. Not non-pharmacological options.
Go ahead.
Do you know Mitchell and Webb? You know that comedy team?
Don't quiz me.
Okay. let me tell you about Mitchell and Webb.
David, much better.
David Mitchell and Robert Webb, these two British comedians, they met at Cambridge in the early 90s. And they're probably best known for a sitcom that they had called Peep Show, which is very funny. But they also had a sketch show called That Mitchell and Webb Look. And my introduction to it was a sketch about an editor. And I like to watch it because it makes me feel like maybe I'm not so bad at my job.
You're not wasting your life.
I'm not sure it convinces me of that. But basically when I watch it, I know I'm not as bad as that guy. In this sketch, David Mitchell, who's often the brainy one, he comes in. He's an author. He's gone to see his editor. And he's telling him about his latest book.
So at the end of chapter 2, Henry is beginning to question his own motives in pursuing the case, and at the same time wondering whether Sarah is telling him the whole story about the divorce.
Yeah, I'm just going to stop you there, Anthony.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, we've just reached the end of chapter 2, and I can't for the life of me tell you what the hell's going on. I mean, you know, Henry, Sarah, these are just words, really.
Right.
I mean, it's great, it's all great, Anthony, obviously, but I just wonder... I mean, just as an example, I mean, not this. I mean, not this at all. Don't do this. But what if, say, the main character dies at the end of chapter 1?
If
I mean, not that, but I mean something like that. I mean, not like that, but yeah? I mean, what if, I mean, not this, ignore this. What if Henry, although obviously not, if he had sex, I mean, not sex, but sex.
Well, that's a great tribute to editors and what they do, isn't it?
Right, exactly. The next time I say, not this, but, yeah. I will remember to stop myself and think again, think a little harder about what I really want to suggest.
What else have you been listening to or reading?
So this is not a quiz, I promise, but are you a crossword puzzle person at all? Do you do the crossword puzzle?
Only on Mondays when I can finish them. Okay. It goes downhill from there.
So I find myself becoming increasingly fond of and dependent on the New York Times crossword puzzle. And there's a blog called Rex Parker Does the New York Times Crossword Puzzle, where and the guy who writes is not actually named Rex Parker. His real name is Michael Sharp. And every day he does the puzzle and then he writes a little review. And it actually is a model of criticism. He's very opinionated, and he makes you appreciate the art of crossword puzzle construction. He's very good on the politics of crossword puzzles, too.
What are the politics of crossword puzzles?
Well, if you think about it, crossword puzzles are a test of what we think of as common knowledge. So, but who's common knowledge, right?
And what are the assumptions?
A lot of cultural references from the 60s and 70s.
Right, a lot of Arlo Guthrie.
Yeah.
Not so much hip-hop.
Yeah. Michael Sharp, he's very good on these things, and he makes you aware of what you're doing in a way that I really appreciate. And then I go back to doing the crossword puzzle.
Does it make you better at the crossword puzzle?
A little bit. Because you notice that, obviously, there are certain words, certain phrases that get used, reused all the time.
Like what?
You know, like Esai Morales, E-S-A-I, very good four-letter word for the crossword puzzle. And that guy, by having that, being the most famous Esai in the United States.
So is it more about cultural assumptions or more about maximum vowels?
It's a little bit of both, a little bit of both. I mean, you know, for instance, maybe there's another Esai. For a long time, R-A-E, right, Ray. You know, Ray Armantrout showed up recently, which was nice as a fan of her work.
Interesting. And what else you've been reading or listening to?
So the last thing I've been turning to a lot recently is music of Lee Moses. And I have a weakness for sort of forgotten or largely forgotten pop musicians. And Lee Moses, he grew up in Atlanta, came to New York in the 1960s, recorded one album, came out in 1971, and that was it. It wasn't a success. He went back to Atlanta, never recorded again. Died in 1997. But over the years, it has built up this kind of cult following. And it's great, and it cheers me up every time I hear it.
The OJs would be happy.
As am I after I hear that song.
Me too. Thanks for coming by, David. Always good to see you.
Good to see you too, David.
David Haglund is an editor at The New Yorker, and you can find links to the comedy duo Mitchell and Webb, the Rex Parker crossword blog, and the soul singer Lee Moses at newyorkerradio.org. Next week, it's the holidays, and we've got a really big treat, a conversation with a true American great, Bruce Springsteen. We'll go all the way back to his beginnings.
Amazingly enough, the music business was such that John Hammond, one of the greatest A&R men and producers, were seeing idiots off the street, you know? And John Hammond says, well, play me something. So I sat down and I closed my eyes and I played him Saint in the City.
I had skin like leather and the diamond hard look of a cobra. I was born blowing weather, but I burst just like a supernova. I could walk like Brando right into the sun, dance just like a Casanova.
Bruce Springsteen, that's next week, and there's more to come this week on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with one of the great reporters around today, Sarah Stillman. And I hope you don't mind if I brag a little bit. She just won a MacArthur Fellowship, better known as the Genius Award. Sarah, you've written for the magazine about issues facing refugees, and you've covered the huge number of people that have been fleeing gang violence and chaos in Central America. But recently you spent an afternoon at a pretend refugee camp. What was that about?
So Doctors Without Borders decided to put on this exhibit, and it's called Forced from Home. And it's currently traveling the country from the East Coast to the West Coast. And it wasn't so much a fake refugee camp as a sort of interactive exhibit that actually tries to simulate in these different stages the various complex steps and choices of people who have actually been forced to flee their homes.
And how does it compare to a real refugee camp? Is it possible to even come close to the sense of packed-inness and desperation that you so often find in refugee camps in the Middle East or wherever you might go?
I mean, to be honest, I was totally skeptical at first. It seemed like, does the financial district really need a chance for people to come and think they've morally absolved themselves by walking around this place? But it turned out to be a kind of step-by-step look into everything from the actual boat journey, like you get inside one of the inflatable rafts, to, you know, what it looks like when Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, sets up these emergency clinics.
And were tourists going in and out of this?
There were all kinds of people. So there were school groups that included populations of kids who were themselves immigrants and in some cases refugees. But then you also saw random stragglers pulled in off the streets. And then perhaps most interesting to me was actually the people who led you through it, which were actual MSF staff members who were fresh from the field, whether dealing with Syrian refugees or, in my case, I went through it with a woman named Dr. Africa Stewart. She's an OBGYN from Georgia. She's worked with MSF in South Sudan, in Nigeria. And so you were getting these people who were kind of radiating a sense of just emerging from the fire of these crises.
I'm thinking, maybe would it make sense to go through the space?
Okay. And yeah. Let me assign your country.
Okay, great. So over here we get our country tags.
So one of the first things we did at the exhibit was to pick up a card that assigned you the country from which you're supposedly fleeing.
So Honduras, South Sudan, Syria, Afghanistan, and Burundi. And some of them are asylum seekers. Some are internally displaced persons, IDPs.
So I chose Honduras. Africa picked South Sudan. There was also a board with cellophane little placards. And each one of them had a picture of an item that you might take with you on it.
So everyone chooses 5 items.
So basically you can choose like what they've got, like a cell phone, water, sewing machine, passport, bottles, keys, wheelchair, guitar.
Some of these items seemed strange to me. Like, why would you bring your keys, for instance? These people are fleeing their homes. They're not, say, going out for groceries.
But it's a sentimental token. People feel like if you lock your door and take your keys, they feel like at one point this will be over and I'm going to go home. And the idea that they just want to come here and have their babies is a lie.
So I went with what I figured was a really practical choice. I chose a passport, water. I chose money and shoes. And then I chose a cell phone because a lot of the Syrian refugees I've spoken to recently have told me that the cell phone was like the most vital item, both in terms of figuring out where they were going. Literally, I've talked to people who spent time Googling, you know, how to not drown while crossing in the Mediterranean in one of these rinky-dink boats. They use WhatsApp to communicate with their smugglers, to communicate with their family members back home in Syria. So that was my thinking behind that choice.
What was the most interesting question that a kid has asked you moving through the exhibit?
The smaller ones are always curious if they should bring their pets. Because they are younger, we are hesitant to tell them that Someone's going to eat your pet. You can't bring
So Dr. Stewart is an obstetrician and a gynecologist with a practice in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. And she's also a mom of three kids. Back in 2011, she and her husband had talked about her going to work with Doctors Without Borders or with MSF, but it didn't feel real until she got a call.
I text him, MSF called, can I go to Sudan? And he texts back, autocorrect is crazy. What'd you say? And I go, no, I want to go to Sudan. It was a little bit of, if I don't go, I know what'll happen. People bleed to death. People, there's no one else who knows how to do what I do. So people walk for miles and just bleed to death, and their babies die. And in this context, when mom is unwell, her other small children are uncared for. And it just sort of changes, it can change a whole village that way. And so I figured out how to make it work. I can cook a cauldron of spaghetti sauce and turn it into four or five different things in the freezer with the label. And
is that what you do before you go off? You, like, prepare the meals for your time away?
Oh, my goodness. It helps, partly because it helps my husband feel like, okay, that's handled, you know, like, that part of it is done. And for the kids, I mean, the way your mom cooks, it's special. So he would do the best he could, but on the weekends, mommy's food. And you only have to do that four times, and then mommy will be home. And it helps.
So we got to the next stage of the exhibit. They'd placed a small kind of inflatable boat of the sort that smugglers actually use to take people across. And I think it's meant to seat around eight people, but they're often finding, you know, 20, 25 people in these boats. And so they essentially crammed the whole tour group just the way that the refugees would be crammed in like sardines in this little boat.
We started, MSF started doing rescues in the water. And we had this whole debate of, are we making the problem worse? Because once the smugglers find out that we're going to come save them, then are they going to take more people out? And we went back and forth for a couple of days, and we decided ultimately that part of our mission is neutrality. If you need us, it doesn't matter how you got into that situation. So in the lifeboat, so we started doing rescues, and the first part of that is getting real life jackets. And we're picking people out of the water that are wearing the equivalent of props. And they were sold them, right? They're not seaworthy, or they're not meant for salt water.
But people are selling those. They're manufacturing basically these fake, crappy life jackets that don't even work. Mm-hmm. That's like such a cynical, I can't even imagine who would think of that idea, but I guess there's a lot of money to be made in this crisis. And can you tell, like, if we look at those two jackets in the boat right there, like, can we tell which one is real and which one's fake?
Yes. I can assure you, if you are given the choice between the two, you'll pick the real one every time.
I see.
But when there aren't any, you can't tell, you know? Yeah.
So then we got to the point in the exhibit where we had to give up another one of our items. I reluctantly chose to give up my cell phone and to hold on to the water because it felt like that was a really requisite object and a cell phone seemed like a really frivolous one. Then, of course, we turn the corner, and Dr. Stewart points out that, you know, we're arriving in the MSF area, and in fact, they did provide the bare essentials, including water, so probably not the best choice.
You don't. As long as you need us, everything that you need is free.
I see. I was about to go into a place with water. Yeah, I guess you make some bad calls. I think that was a bad call. I screwed myself.
And that people always saying, like, oh, can I get that back? No. Because
I'll totally
that's part
my
of the
cell phone back if you'll give it to me. No.
That's part of the experience, though, is choosing incorrectly and finding out later that you needed that thing or you did, or this is useless.
Yeah, it's interesting to think that in this current refugee climate that one of the most valuable things you could possibly have is a cell phone. And so later she took me to this part of the exhibit where they displayed these really innovative, creative ways that refugees had come up with in the camps to charge the phones, just impromptu self-made chargers. So at that point, we transitioned to the tents, which are, you know, the longer-term living stations, the things you've heard about in the news.
Mostly to sort of illustrate the idea that people are fleeing for months and months. If you don't drown, you aren't kidnapped, you don't get shot along the way. This is it.
I mean, it's a real hole, to be honest. I mean, it looks like a bunch of plastic tarps draped over and really looks like a lot of what we would conceptualize as trash. I mean, there's a little doll made out of trash and garbage bags and a little toy made out of a milk carton with some wheels attached. But otherwise, it's just these little tents and flip-flops and the flimsiness that almost is a physical representation of these people's situations in terms of precarious. Like, it looks like the wind could blow away this whole place.
And this is long-term housing. This is what they fled to. So if you can appreciate that this is good news to a lot of families, then it shines a light on what they left. The seriousness of it, the lack of safety, warmth.
The exhibit ends there, but it definitely left me thinking, partly just about how I'd walked into it feeling pretty skeptical. I just have big questions about the nature of these exercises where, even as we try to build empathy for those going through the refugee crisis, how often are we doing that in ways that are really just self-congratulatory chances to momentarily pause from our days, quickly imagine what it's like to be someone in one of these, in these dire straits, and then to just jump back into our lives and pat ourselves on the back for having done so, but without any real stakes on the line, without really any action being taken. And this left me thinking, actually, the value in the exhibit lay elsewhere, and I think it lay in two places. And the first was really just getting outside the binaries that so much of the reporting on the refugee crisis play into, and I think those fall into either the category of tales of refugees who were really exceptional and wildly resilient and really, really special in their courage and bravery, or the tales of the kind of faceless masses. But this exhibit was really about the smaller daily choices that millions of people are making again and again and again. And it also made me think about, well, what is Dr. Stewart getting out of all of this? And it became pretty quickly clear that all of the doctors there were really having one of the first chances they'd had to talk with each other about the really intense environments in which they're operating in all these far-flung parts of the world, then sharing that with the rest of us, that there is an element of, you know, education that's an equally important part of the job.
I can get lost in the operating room. I can just be doing sexual violence repair after repair after repair, or doing fistula repair after repair after repair, because that's the thing that I can do. Most of what I use practically, I learned from my colleagues. The first thing I learned is, you don't cry in front of the staff. It is better to be respected than loved. Don't cry in front of the staff. I mean, I have some secrets that I'll never speak to another soul, because it's just too heavy. But every now and again, I can call Denmark and talk to Anya, and she knows why I called. And we don't even have to talk about it. We can just say, it could have been worse. We did the right thing. I just hate how it turned out. So we get the training. We get it, but we get it on the fly. And sometimes it's some Australian going, "Ay, buck up." Okay. Sometimes that's all I needed. Just, okay, I'm back on it. Wash your hands. Do it again. Just don't give up. And I always say I'm not going back to the field, and I do. Always. I probably have it in my chat with my husband. I'm never coming back. Never. It's too much. I'm too old for this crap. And he's like, uh-huh. We'll talk about it when you get help. Because he's right.
That's Dr. Africa Stewart, an OBGYN in the Atlanta area and a member of Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. She talked with the New Yorker staff writer Sarah Stillman. And the exhibit, Forced from Home, will continue its tour next year. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and that's it for today. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving with people who matter to you. And next week, my conversation is one of the great songwriters and performers ever, Bruce Springsteen. Don't miss it. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.